The big black bug, but the big black bear. Blah, 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 blah.
The big black bear, blood, black blood.
We're like a hip hop group. It's like
the big black bug, but the big black bear.
We're like Run DMC. You know? We're just finishing each other's rhymes.
We're giving Bennett ammo. Don't get Bennett ammo.
The Mustache Man is back. John Bolton was on CNN to share the fantasy view of the military-industrial complex's perspective on Ukraine. We'll be diving into that. And we're returning to tariffs because nigh everyone is getting them wrong, according to my co-host, Kyle. Kyle, how you doing,
man? Ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Welcome back to Human Reaction. We're down Joe today, but...
Boo.
Eventually, all of us will be in the same room together. You know, it's just how it is. It'd be like that sometimes. But make sure, if you've been enjoying our content, make sure to comment and subscribe and leave a review on whichever platform that you're watching us on. And let us know how you're feeling about all this tariff nonsense that's going on and these trade wars and peace in Ukraine and
all that stuff.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
What is going on with John Bolton?
Yes. So, believe it or not, he's still a bloodthirsty hack. Uninterested
John
in
Bolton?
Engaging with anything of substance.
Are we talking about the same John Bolton?
Yeah, the guitar, the singer.
The that's singer. What I'm talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's Michael Bolton.
Right. He's another disciple Bolton. Okay, so a little bit of background here, and then we'll dive into the clip. We covered this some on Tuesday, me and Joe. Mm-hmm. But as of today, Steve Witkoff is on his way back to Russia for more peace-making, deal-making thing. Zelensky came out in the press after last week's, you know, incremental gain on some agreed terms, specifically saying that it is impossible for him because of constitutional reasons, and I suspect because of, you know, ego reasons, admit that Crimea, the piece of land that with the naval base on it from Russia that they took in 2014. But the bloodless clue. Yeah.
It's like Clue, but bloodless.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Candlestick in the
super friendly.
Ring.
Yeah. That one. That's the one that they're planting their flag and say, no, we cannot possibly acknowledge that. So he came on to CNN to give his take.
Well, of course he's got favorites, and his favorite is not Russia. His favorite is Vladimir Putin, whom he thinks is his friend. Trump has already made major concessions to the Russians. He has said weeks and months ago that he would not support Ukraine being restored to its full sovereignty and territorial integrity, which is a rejection of the U.S. position and the NATO position going back to February 24th, 2022, when the Russians invaded. Trump has said that Ukraine will never become a member of NATO, which is a rejection of the U.S. position since 2008, when George W. Bush first advocated. He said that there will be no NATO security guarantees. This basically lays down central elements of what Russia already wants, and that has affected the negotiations, which, by the way, have been more about a ceasefire than a permanent peace settlement. A permanent deal is a long way away.
Yeah, so full restoration of Ukraine. If you deviate from that position, you're betraying America, Kyle. That's what I got from that.
You're deviating from the NATO position because NATO needs to be kept whole. And yes, it's the thing that we've always had to deal with. Putin's the best friend of Trump.
Yeah, which is just another part of that, like he's a fascist argument coming out again. I mean, they're really not doing anything new. They're just repeating the same thing that they've repeated since 2017.
Well, it is kind of like when I laid out my whole Europe is the enemy thesis a few episodes ago, right? Like a lot of this is front running the idea of actual peace with Russia, because wouldn't that be kind of good for the world if there was actual peace with Russia?
No, it's terrible. They're trying to reestablish the Soviet Empire, which we'll get in a minute. But the sheer absurdity of NATO membership being like the most important thing for American foreign policy is just so crazy, right? I mean, just because Bush said it was a good idea in 2008, why would we not want to pivot away from that horrible foreign policy? Right? Especially given the fact that that's one of the primary causes of the war in the first place. So, of course, he has to pivot away from the 2008 security guarantee talk, because it's one of the reasons why we're here in the first place. And hundreds of thousands of people have died, and all of this wasted money and effort over a security project that, you know, might have been more about natural gas than actually about, you know, anything else.
Oh, yeah.
But also was, you know, an effort to encircle Russia. And I'm not saying this because I'm pro-Russian. I'm saying this because I want the war to end, because guess what? War is hell. It's really bad. So how do you not, you know, how does this happen? And especially I want to just note this, given the internet debate on credentialism. He's an expert. This is Peter Hotez telling you that, guess what? We need to do all the vaccines because it's going to prevent transmission or transmission of disease. Right. Mm-hmm. It's the same, like, from your expert opinion of having served in presidents, you're going to give me exactly the approved pharmaceutical or approved military industrial complex opinion that is so completely predictable that persists the very thing that we're actually that the administration is trying to pivot away from.
Well, it's interesting, too, here, because like everybody's just playing narrative games here right now. And, you know, we're watching, you know, Witkoff's over in Russia, and we're watching Zelensky was on Ben Shapiro's show doing an interview. And and so everything's just kind of narrative games. Everybody has their thing that they have to figure out.
That was all blurry. Go ahead. Keep going. Okay. Yeah.
Everybody kind of has their whole the thing that they're trying to get out of this right now. And, you know, it does kind of suck for Ukraine in a sense where they're the most likely outcome in this is that they're going to be giving up territory. Like, this is just the most likely outcome, and like that's unfortunate for them, I guess, but I don't know, like it's just we've been going through this for so long. There's like 5,000 people a week dying on both sides of this, and at some point you got to just say enough's enough. Somebody's got to make some concessions here. We got to start to move towards some relative peace program. But there's a lot of people, especially in the European like the European aspect here, that sees Zelensky as this frontline war hero that is their bulwark for the system that they have created over the last several decades. Mm-hmm. And he is the front line, and that's where Zelensky's bread is buttered. So he has to appease to that, and he has to kind of keep going there. Otherwise, you know, otherwise he's probably not long for this world. That's like the unfortunate reality of how this world works.
Yeah.
And NATO's kind of at this point where if there's actual peace that is made between the United States and between Russia, then it makes the whole NATO thing obsolete.
Right.
Like, it's just like you have Europe has been America's primary ally for so long. And if Russia stops being the primary enemy, it makes Europe as the primary ally less relevant.
Right. Right.
We could say, on the world stage. I
mean, at a minimum, you have the direct incentive of the military industrial complex and all the weapon sales and all the money and all that kind of stuff. But on the second to that, I think what you're pointing to here is that there's a perverse incentive for the self-licking ice cream cone of NATO to continue NATO for its own sake, because that's where all that's coming from.
Well, so, because like the entire European like economic system is based around NATO's existence.
Yeah, right. Like, all of their regulation of their economy and all that kind of stuff can be subsidized because they don't have to worry about growing aggressively because they're protected by American tax dollars.
Like Europe isn't a better place if Russia and America are enemies. Like, that's the game theory of this whole thing.
At least that's how they see it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like...
geopolitically, it's probably true.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that. What do you mean by that, I guess?
Because they're like our welfare queens in this whole deal, right? Like, they get to just kind of, like, sit there and be passenger princess throughout the whole endeavor this, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm being more prescriptive than that. What I'm saying is, if there was peace with Russia, that would mean all of that military spending on NATO would now get to go to use more productive opportunities.
That's never how anything works.
Well, right? What I mean is that's how that would be best for the people of Europe. Of course.
Oh, yeah. Because
the Ukrainians count with that, right?
If they diverted that spending elsewhere, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, things change when they change, right? Yeah. So if they were to change and you actually were to get a pivot in peace with Russia and a pivot away from Europe as a welfare queen, that would be better for the welfare queen.
You know,
is the case.
Something that I find very interesting in this negotiation process is the role that Steve Witkoff has played in all of it. Is because, like, so if people don't know, Steve Witkoff is like Trump's best friend and real estate, like a fellow real estate guy out of New York.
Yeah.
He was actually who Trump was golfing with when the second assassination attempt happened. Mm. And he's been operating in both the Middle Eastern negotiations side of stuff, but also the Russia side of stuff.
He's had touches on the Hamas negotiations, Iran, and Russia.
But so. It's just interesting. But he's not the State Department.
Well, yeah. Like, imagine you're Marco Rubio, yeah, and you show up on your first day in the job. He's like, actually, my buddy's going to do all the important stuff. You just hear that's window dressing.
That's the interesting thing to me is Marco seems to be relegated to more so Central American politics.
Well,
like he's still, yeah, he's involved in Ukraine, yeah, and stuff like that. But like, it seems more so that that's his role is like, hey, we're going to use the State Department for our soft power efforts in Central America, which is important. Like, I actually think that's like a good role for him, to be honest. Like, and I would prefer seeing him less so, like him in the State Department, less so intertwined with the Middle East and the Ukraine situation. Because like this is also another element is like Witkoff's gone and done multiple of these meetings, like 5-hour sit downs with Putin.
Yeah.
And like, we're not getting leaks out of that.
Yeah.
Like, that's an important factor to know. Like, if this is the State Department, imagine the leakage.
Yeah, right. I mean, we are getting the public statements out of it. Mm-hmm. And this is a lot of to reaction to that. So let's continue to play in here. And we'll see what his actual vision is. Just keep playing.
Keep playing from here.
Yep.
Okay.
But what do you make of everything you just laid out there? Still hasn't resulted in a ceasefire. Why do you think that is?
Because that amounts to surrender for Ukraine. These are the Russian positions that then give them the basis after they regroup and rebuild their army for the third invasion of Ukraine to finish what Putin and the Kremlin began back in 2005, announcing it publicly to the world that they were about recreating the Russian Empire. And that includes, critically, getting control of Ukraine. This Trump approach to Russia, I think, is a critical mistake for the United States. This will be one of the biggest reversals of policy in history. It will have ramifications for American national security all over the world. And as Trump says, he doesn't really care about it. He just wants to do it to get the war behind him. That's all he really cares about.
What do you make of how it seems he's very frustrated that he's approaching 100 days in office and still there is no agreement, nothing?
Well, in part because he doesn't understand what this war is all about. He has said several.
All right. So what is the war all about? And do the American is Trump acting on behalf of the American people, or is he acting on behalf of Trump? Now, they need to create this narrative that Trump is just trying to do this for selfish reasons because he's a Putin puppet or whatever.
Yeah, I don't really understand what those selfish reasons are, per se, but...
Well, I mean, he just thinks he's his friend, and he just wants to be appreciated by dictators. That's really what they think.
Yeah,
they actually psychologize the guy into that position so that they can live in the fantasy world where the American public care about whether or not the Kremlin or Kyiv control the Donbass. You know, and it's like 60% of the Donbass too, not even the entire thing.
Yeah.
But like, if you freeze the lines now, they're not even getting the whole thing. They are getting all of Crimea, but they've had that since 2014. So, yeah, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like, he said, it's a pivot away. It's a pivot away from American foreign policy doctrine in the past. Well, how's that working out for us? How's American foreign policy doctrine working out for us exactly? $35 trillion in debt, a massive bloated defense budget. Completely unaccountable. The only people who are trying to pivot that away are getting ejected out of the DOD as staffers, you know, Dan Caldwell and those guys. And you're over here saying, well, actually, we don't actually know. Everything was going so great, CNN, that we got to continue the pathway. Otherwise, American security is at stake. What American security interest do we have here? What is the interest? And then he's just saying like, oh, he goes on to be like, this is, oh, well, that just sends a signal to the Chinese that we're unwilling to defend Taiwan, as if that was a critical American security interest as well, on the same pathway as Ukraine, as if these are not two different countries in two different places in the world with completely different economic relationships with America. On your own terms, they're different.
My understanding of the logistics of, because like, so much of the argument is like, well, no, if we just let Putin do this, he's going to keep marching forward. It's a very like, they're going to keep expanding the Russian Empire and keep going forward. But my understanding of like the actual logistics of this is that Russia runs very highly on rails, like, and the rails only get them so far, and they would have to build out like whole new infrastructure for them to continue marching beyond this current point, like actually just like logistically, like from their military perspective.
Interesting.
So like it's one of these things where it's like, it's very easy for, you know, people like this to just kind of put out these brazen ideas forward.
Kyle, he's been there.
Yeah. He's been there. But my understanding is just like, it would actually be incredibly difficult for him to do that.
Right.
To the point where it doesn't make sense for that to be his interest.
Right.
Right. Like he has a very important strategic position with the Black Sea that he's concerned about. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, he's not really concerned to go that far. Like Russia's already a very big place. They got a lot of stuff. They don't need to expand across all of Europe. Like that would be foolish, just even from an economic standpoint, for like that wouldn't actually really be in his interest to do that,
right? You know? So there's this entire edifice built up that's been building in order to justify our aggression with Russia for quite some time, ever since Donald Trump came into the administration, and it's all based upon this idea that he has of the reemergence of the Russian Empire and the USSR, and that Vladimir Putin said some things that they are just latching onto that and ignoring everything else. And so if you knock down that one part, the entire thing collapses, because the whole argument is that there's no other strategic interest that they could have. And the only way to see that is to have zero strategic empathy whatsoever. And that's what you're doing. You're exercising strategic empathy. Yeah. You're saying they have an interest. They want a buffer for reasons, right? And how good are those reasons? Well, we've covered that pretty thoroughly.
Ad nauseam,
yeah. And they're very good, and they're reasonable reasons. So if you're engaging in that space with any amount of good faith, you come to the conclusion of, well, wait a minute. Why would they go extend beyond this if they've secured their, you know, what they're concerned about when it comes to their security? Right. They've been warning us all this whole time, too. All the things that they ignore of their warnings of saying, hey, this is the reddest of red lines. Don't cross. Don't force us to do this, because this is a security problem for us. They ignore in favor of the security guarantee, and the USSR reemergence narrative. So,
there's also just like, I've watched quite a bit of Putin. Like I've watched quite a bit of speeches, you know,
the
speeches that we're kind of allowed to. I don't get this is the unfortunate reality of this, is like, we actually don't get a lot of Russian information here and vice versa.
Not anymore.
There's all these blockages that happen. Well, especially with like Sputnik and RT and stuff like that, being shut down during the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't get this expansionist vibe from him. Like nothing like, when he talks about the way the Russian Empire used to be and stuff like that, like that's much more of a nationalistic call to strength.
Right. It's the same way.
It's the same thing as make America great again.
It'd be like Merkel's Germany being worried because we are celebrating World War II history, right?
Yeah.
Like in America's triumphant over the Nazis. These guys are not the commies. These are the guys who overthrew the commies in the 90s. And they have a very different set of interests, a very different set of beliefs that are not the same. So why are we treating them as if nothing happened from the mid-90s till 2005?
But yeah, it's also because like you also always are throwing, he's a KGB thug and stuff like that. But it's like Putin went against the KGB. He resigned. Like, and he went against them.
Yeah. Well, he was like, he was also more of a, and this is interesting too. When we were talking with Scott Horton, he was like, no, the guy's like a clerk. Like he's not an assassin. Right, he was a clerk. He was a paper pusher.
Yeah, he's a bureaucrat.
Right,
like that's
so. Like we're not talking about crazy military guy. We're talking about is a regular dude. You know, not. I mean, irregular in many ways, of course.
No, yeah, and, no, he's definitely not regular.
Yeah, right. But like, not the thing that you think of when you think KGB thug.
Well, it's just like, yeah, kind of what I'm getting at is like, because there's all these like words that are used to invoke emotion that John Bolton is using. Like, he's trying to bring back the Russian Empire, and whenever people are just like, he's a thug, he's a criminal, he's like all that stuff just like washes over me, you know? Because it's just I've heard that so much, and it just doesn't really mean anything. It's just like, yeah, okay. Leaders of countries are thugs and criminals. Like, okay, yeah, sure, I guess. Like,
it's easy. When you assume that all political leadership is by definition exploitative, you're going to be in a situation where you're like, well, yeah, they're all kind of that way.
Well, it's just, yeah, like, that's what the president is. He's a mafia don. Like, that's what the president's role is. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually something I kind of appreciate about Trump, is like, it's actually much more just blatantly like, no, I'm a mafia don, rather than dressing it up in all of this like theatrics around it. It's like, no, this is what the game
no,
is.
No, you gotta like, conduct the right rituals, Kyle. That's what you're missing, is you're not doing the ritual.
That's the thing about this, is just like, they're not conducting the right rituals, and everybody just like, their minds get warped and triggered, and they just fall into this malaise of like, yes, he's a thug, and he's a criminal. what it comes down to is like, it's not the same ritualistic practice that we go into, and then we can continue to push this stuff, right?
So J.D. Vance was interviewed on the tarmac about the kind of this development, and we have John Bolton's response, which is just too delicious not to do.
Yeah. We've issued a very explicit proposal to both the Russians and the Ukrainians, and it's time for them to either say yes or for the United States to walk away from this process. And the only way to really stop the killing is for the armies to both put down their weapons, to freeze this thing, and to get on with the business of actually building a better Russia and a better Ukraine.
If the U.S. does walk away, what do you think that means for relations with Russia from the United States' perspective? Do they try to normalize them after that and essentially just leave this, or what could that look like?
Yes, I think they leave Ukraine in the dust. When Vance says we're giving Russia and Ukraine terms that they should agree to, he's saying Ukraine should surrender 20% of its territory in response to two acts of unprovoked aggression over the last 10 years. This is a roadmap for Red China, sorry, Freudian slip, for People's Republic of China to go after Taiwan, to continue to go after the South China Sea, for Russia to take aggression action elsewhere in the territory of the former Soviet Union, and in fact, the license for rogue states around the world. It's not necessarily Trump's view, but I think it is Vance's view. This is a significant American retreat from responsibility for its own national security globally.
Yes. So like this is the drums are beating, and a lot of people are still there, right? They're still like interfacing with this, and they need to contend with it. Now, at each one of those steps, surrender 20% of Ukraine. Should they do that? Well, what else are we going to do? What's the plan? What's the alternative? Just keep fighting forever until every last Ukrainian's dead?
Yeah.
And not gain back that 20%? I mean, you could Douglas Murray that and just be like, we're going to live in the fantasy world of, if we just keep supporting them, they'll win. When that might not be true. Like, isn't it best for Americans?
He was there. He knows they can win.
Yeah. Assuming the money isn't all free, right? And it's just all magical dollars that we can just print forever without any consequence. Isn't it better for Americans to have, you know, to not care about the 20% of Ukraine instead of get to peace? Especially given the fact that we're, you know, doing operations, they have nukes. We have nukes, you know, finger over the button sort of thing.
That's the, just because the Douglas Murray thing just is constantly going to be popping up. And it was a real, like,
we're not done yet, man.
Moment. Yeah. Like, it was a real moment in kind of the culture of American politics. Just interesting to see Dave Smith at the center of it. He's become such like a superstar. That's interesting to see. But like, there's just something strange to be said about like, why do we have all these like European commentators coming in and telling us what we should be doing with our money? Constantine, Douglas Murray, like, they're the, like, why are they the ones leading the charge in this?
Yeah. John Bolton spent quite a bit of time in Europe, just saying.
No, but like, John Bolton's the common like neocon thread, but it's like in the internet commentary at class.
Right.
Like, it's all these European guys
that
are coming. Like, that's, like, it triggers me.
Right.
You're like, bro, you're not even from here. what are you doing? Like,
yeah. That has been his shtick since the early 2000s, right? Is advocating for America to go to war. And, you know, if you pattern that with the European, you know, flip, that, you know, the future of American security is skepticism of European security interests. Mm-hmm. They can handle it themselves. You know, that is very dangerous to their, you know, to the shtick that they've been on for a very long time.
Well, and that's a big deal on when it comes to, like, we'll get more into this a little bit later with the tariff stuff. But that is a conversation on the European side of the trade war, is NATO, is they're not paying their fair share in NATO and what they're obligated to pay for. And so the tariffs are partly because of that on their end. Like, those are the different variables that they used at different countries. So like, that is the pressure point on the Europeans to actually like yo, pay up. We're doing this thing.
Yeah,
like,
right.
You promised a thing and you're not doing it. And you're trying to like mess around with all these other, with all this other stuff. And we see what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the dynamic at play there on the diplomacy side.
Well, you do wonder, so just to steel man the other side here is, and I think it's a legitimate criticism. Should NATO protection have come with a, your markets have to be open for our exports? Or is that the original deal? I don't think that was the original deal. Or was that, or is it, should they should have said that at the creation of NATO? Because that's like, it's a particular mercantile like approach that is probably better than like showing up to say, do this or we'll blow you up. It's do this or we'll protect.
I think there's certain things, and it's maybe better to get more into when we're more in context of the full trade war.
Yeah.
But like, I think there's certain things of, with America having the currency reserve status that it has, there's certain obligations and meetings and commitments that were made during, say, like the Plaza Accords in 1980 and things like that, of like how we're all supposed to work together under this economic order.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of people trying to skirt the rules and find loopholes to all of those things. Mm. And then the Trumpian argument is like, no, we see what you're doing and we are going to bully you until you come into commitment or we revise the negotiations at the table. Like that's the kind of,
and NATO being part of that, I mean there. And you could see that too, especially after you've been subsidizing.
NATO's a big piece of that.
You see, you can see that you can, it's sensible. In fact, even the Mises people recommended this, is saying, hey, if you want lower trade tariffs in Europe, just threaten NATO funding. You know, threaten to pull out of NATO and the security guarantee,
which is part of what's going on.
Right. So like
this is like a multivariable attack that's going on, right?
I mean, beyond the tariffs, is there is rather than tariffs, but I could see you could do it with them both. So and then of course Trump tweeted, Vladimir, stop. Let's get this peace deal done, which was taken by the of course by the corporate press as, oh man, he's tweeting at his buddy in weakness. Like this is a weak move.
This isn't. He said, I'm not happy with the Russian strikes on Kiev. Not necessary and very bad timing. Vladimir, stop. 5,000 soldiers a week are dying. Let's get the peace deal done. Also, I actually have a clip here from both Trump and Rubio when they were in a cabinet meeting.
Oh, okay.
I believe, where they're talking about exactly this. And let me get the actual correct link. It is kind of one of these things where... I find it does feel kind of like it'd be a shame if another missile came and hit you again, Zelensky. Like it does kind of feel like that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But here's them talking.
Peace based upon that, just getting to that 30-day ceasefire.
I don't think so. I think that they both want peace right now. They're ready to do something. We'll see what happens. Complicated, very complicated. But I think they are both very much looking to make a deal. Marco, what would you say?
Well, first of all, the what was put before our partners was options to discuss about things that it would take to end a war. This war is endable. Both sides just have to agree to it. We've shown them a pathway forward. We've discussed those ideas. There was a good meeting yesterday. There'll be good meetings over the weekend. We've shown them the finish line. We need both of them to say yes. But what happened last night with those missile strikes should remind everybody of why this war needs to end. It's horrible those missiles landed. What's even worse is there are today people that were alive yesterday that are not alive today, because this war continues and the president wants to stop it. And everyone should be thanking the president for being a peacemaker and trying to save lives. That's what we're trying to do here. It's not our war. We didn't start it, as you know. But we're trying to end the dying. We're trying to end the destruction. And we've shown the path forward. We can see the finish line, but both of them have to get there. We're going to do everything we can to help them get there, but they have to ultimately say yes.
Both. And we are using a lot of pressure on both. You know, if you think we're just in there because we're nice people, and we are nice people, but we're using a lot of pressure on both.
So, interesting to hear them kind of say they're talking about the missile strike, too. And,
yeah.
But
it's an impediment, but it's also pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So like Zelensky is the one who is saying, no, we can't do that on Crimea right now. And is the missile strikes a response to that? You know, I think that's a fair interpretation of what maybe the Russian Federation's strategic interest is in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also there is one thing, and this is something that I think is going to be very symbolically significant in the history books in the future is this Putin sent this painting back with Witkoff after their meeting.
Whoa.
And for the listeners only, it is a painting by a famous painter who's like known for painting, like it's a Russian painter who's known for painting about current events and stuff like that. Mm. But it's a painting of Trump with his fist in the air, blood on his face, flag in the background, kind of famously as from the assassination attempt, with the Statue of Liberty in the background. Mm. And Putin gave this as a gift to Trump. And I think that this is going to be something that's like in the history books will be one of those like symbolically significant things that people will talk about in the future. Yeah. Like right now, it seems like a very small thing because this stuff is not all worked out yet.
Right.
But it's going to be, it's one of those things where it's like, well, you know, you're in your high school history book and there'll be a paragraph talking about like how the war ended and it'll have this paint, like it'll have this painting in there. Mm. I think that this is going to be one of those things.
Well, the question is if it's going to be Russia unprovoked and attacked, America's ally, Ukraine, and we backed them. And then, you know, we elected a guy who loved
Putin.
Authoritarianism and he ended it because he got a nice painting. Or is it going to be something that approaches the truth? Like that's that. And I always find myself in this place whenever I'm seeing major events happen. I'm like, how are people going to understand this going forward? Mm-hmm. Right. It's just like World War II ended the Great Depression. Right. It's true in a sense, but it's actually so low resolution. Yeah. You lose almost all the important detail to actually give you insight into what that means. And so people will operate like, oh, all we have to do, we'll take from that the lesson. All we have to do to end a depression is go to war someplace. You know, like that's not the right way to think about it. But there you are when you kind of had that low resolution picture and you allow for the kind of core intellectuals to define your history.
Yeah. Well, I think some of it, a lot of this will be dependent on, because the winners always write the history, right? Like that's always the phrase where we are in the transitionary period of a new order in the world. Like, I think it's very clear that that's happening. And the Russian negotiations and also the results of these trade wars, I think are the two probably biggest variables in how that order shakes up in the future. And so it'll be the history books in that new paradigm that will be writing it. So it's like, if Trump is victorious in kind of all of these different avenues, then I think it'll probably be pleasantly written about him in that sense. But if not, and like some of these fall apart, then we'll probably see a reversion back to how we've kind of been seeing everything play out in the past and how the court historians or whatever would talk about these things.
Right.
And that'll be there's a battle over history that is taking place now. Right.
Someday I'll be a podcaster and be like, you're doing that controversial history.
That revisionist history.
That revisionist history where Donald Trump wasn't a Putin puppet. Are you kidding me? Yeah. How could you? You know,
obviously we know Russia hoax. What are you talking about? Because that's kind of what I'm seeing. If this Russia United States alliance becomes a thing, and as I think is where we're moving towards, like that is a reshaping of everything. Like so much of the last few centuries were defined by not allowing that to happen because Europe was still the center of the world.
Right.
And as they're getting squeezed out and they're just becoming increasingly less relevant, it's like, we're going to see that fade away. And that's where I think everything moves Pacific. Like we just, it's actually in the book, The Network State by Balaji Srinivasan, he talks about this where the course of history, everything's moved further and further westward, where it's just like you have everything kind of in Mesopotamia area. And then like century after century, the power center of the cultural center of the world continues moving forward. Huh. And right now where it's currently at is kind of in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And then we're going to be continuing moving further and further. And that's where I think that we're seeing where it's like we're doing a trip around the world over all these millennia, and we're just going to see, it's like it's China, Russia, America right there, right? And it's like, but all of this stuff needs to play out in time for us to see that.
So what you're saying is the reason why we got to take Greenland is because they're the center of the world now.
Yeah, they are. That's currently the center of the world. It's like Iceland,
it's
Greenland,
all coming together now.
It's like we can't let Denmark keep getting away with it. So let's move into the restructuring of this global order and what's going on. Because something that has been irritating the hell out of me is there's like three good people on Twitter about this that are actually talking about what's actually happening. And then everybody else that's just like saying shit. Right.
Well, I mean, I think it is difficult because as I have consumed stuff around this, it's really hard to find people who are hitting every angle and not just the angle that best suits their books.
Yeah, right? whatever their ideological preferences, that's right. where they sit in, and right. like, they stick to that one note, and just like it's forest versus trees, right? Yeah. Like everybody has their tree that they're really interested, and they're like, ooh, that's some nice bark on that tree, and then they talk about that tree only, and it's like, bro, we're trying to have a conversation about the forest,
yeah,
right? Like that's.
So hit me with the forest. What's give me a good example of this silly talk on trade.
You know, I'll play this clip. I got a clip from MSNBC, and because the great folks over at MSNBC,
they always do such a good job. Especially talking about markets and trade offs.
They really know about markets. They really know about markets. I'll tell you that. Here's just a little bit of this.
White House is leaking out these stories to sort of elevate.
Let me remove those captions.
Scott Bessent to try to make us believe, right? Because for the last 2 weeks, people are going, man, I miss Gary Cohn. I miss Steve Mnuchin. I miss Jared Kushner. There are no guardrails on this president.
Right.
So now they're trying to make us believe, well, Scott Bessent is the man in charge. He's going to he's going to help Donald Trump. And Donald Trump's gotten some bad advice.
Yeah.
But we keep pegging Peter Navarro as the one to blame. Peter Navarro's views are Donald Trump's views. Right. It's not that he's getting bad advice. Donald Trump has been expressing these views on trade for 40 years.
Yeah. Well, two things can be true. One is that, yes, this is Donald Trump's worldview. He's been wanting to do this since the 80s, maybe even prior to then, and that Peter Navarro is sort of a reflection of that worldview. The other thing that is true is that Donald Trump can be persuaded to do things depending on who is the last person to talk to him. And so we get a lot of these stories about how Howard Lutnick and Scott Bessent are, you know, strategically running in when Peter Navarro is on the other side of the White House complex so they can just get Donald Trump's ear. I will note, to your point, there's been a lot of strategic leaking about how Scott Bessent is, you know, talking to J.P. Morgan, talking to all these business leaders and giving them what they want to hear as a way to almost calm the markets, right? But ultimately, and you would know this better than I do, this stuff, this chaos, this constant up and down, it will have a long-term impact. And that's why you see the dollar weakening. It's why you see what you see in the bond markets. Yes, they may end up cutting deals. But if you're a foreign country, a foreign government, you certainly have to look at the long term and say, is it wise to put all our eggs in the U.S. basket, or should we start looking at cutting other deals that maybe can circumvent around the United States market?
Okay. So that's kind of often the general assessment that is happening from the talking heads all the time,
right?
Is they're kind of just like, it's the same note over and over again. Trump's been wanting to do this for 40 years, like Scott Bessent critiquing the people that are talking about the Bessent short, which is like they're kind of critiquing me in that fashion, right?
Yeah.
It was like, that's something I've talked about on the show several times now. But like, they're not actually tackling anything that's happening right now. Like, they're not tackling what the actual arguments are being made from the Trump administration, Trump himself, but also the people around him. Like, nobody's actually talking about those things. And there's like, you can actually just go listen to what they're saying or read the reports, the economic reports that they're making where they're discussing the plans. Mm. Like, you can do that.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
it almost seems like as an expert reporter, that would be the first thing you would do.
Like, and it's actually the thing is, like, I went this week and I reread, because I had read this before. This is how I kind of like came to my conclusions of where they were. I read Stephen Moran's report that he wrote in November of last year. So it's not like this, that's not going on willy-nilly. Because like, that's the argument is like, oh, Trump speaks to one person and then he changes his mind and he only listens to the last person that he talked to.
Well, right?
Like that's the argument.
Yeah. They're making that argument, I think, because they're tied into what he says, not what he does. Right. So what he says will say one thing, depending on the person, last person talked to him. And a lot of people observe that, especially on foreign policy, especially in the last administration, Trump 1.0. But it seems like, you know, there is, I think if you're not familiar with the deeper stuff here that you're pointing to, there does seem to be like a whiplash happening where they're high, they're low, they're suspended, they're not suspended, and all that kind of stuff. And so people get the impression that's where that argument comes from.
Well, and this is the thing is like, people say that, like, even on the foreign policy stuff, like, the more I study Trump, the more that's just not the case of him just like taking the word of the last person he talked to.
Mm.
Like, that's not like Trump to me seems to operate with this. There's like kind of a higher end goal of what we're working towards. But there's oftentimes you don't want to get too bogged down in the details of A, B, C, D, E, F, G before you get to Z. So you kind of want to take A at a time, B at a time, do A, reassess, do B, reassess.
Yeah.
And that is like a common theme. And like, to even the point where the people around him say that too. like they will actually make that point when they're asked about this on podcasts, right? But like, yeah, so like I went and read Stephen Moran's, this is what the report is called, A User's Guide to Restructuring the Global Trade System.
Whoa.
Written in November, he is currently the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in Trump 2.0, which is like a nominated position. He leads the council that advises Trump on economic policy, right? And he wrote the user guide back in November before he was selected for this. Like, even in their report, they're like, what Scott Bessent, who may or may not be the Treasury Secretary, like it says that in the, like, right, this right. is, we're going back okay. all this long time ago, 6 months ago or whatever.
To my God, forever but ago.
Where they talk about these things and where they talk about how are we going to determine who gets tariffed and how much tariffs, because it's not necessarily just about purely reciprocal tariffs. It's also about what are the other things that they're doing to us.
Do they mention the penguins? Like they got going after the penguins.
Well, it's kind of interesting because they do talk about loopholes. And I had talked about how the penguin thing was an IQ test on, do you understand that this is how China would divert and make loopholes around the system, right? So they talk about the loophole thing. They don't name that island specifically, but they talk about that in the report.
Right.
And it's just here, like I'll just put, some of the stuff is, okay, what countries are tariffing us? That's like step one. And very specifically, they say the Bessent strategy. He suggests using the Bessent strategy of putting countries into buckets based off of varying criteria in order for us to inform our trade policy around that individual country. Mm-hmm. So like what countries are tariffing us, which is a fair question that for some reason nobody asks. It's like other countries also tariff us back.
Yes. Right?
Like that's a fair question to ask, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But like nobody ever talks about that, which is always shocking to me. Do they have a history of suppressing their currency? Example, excessive accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. Excessive is the key word. There's an expectation as us being the reserve currency.
Yeah.
But like there's an excessive and then the manipulation of those markets, which is what China and Europe does. Right, like they manipulate to peg their currency.
Yeah.
Right. Respect American IP rights. Are they open to U.S. firms? Are they as open to U.S. firms as we are to foreign firms? So like we allow a lot of foreign firms in.
Yeah.
Are they open to us having our firms there? You know, like are they open to that?
Right. Right.
That's the thing. Do they help China evade tariffs? That's the loophole thing, mm-hmm. right? Do they pay their NATO obligations in full? There's the Europe thing, right? Who do they tend to side with in international disputes at the UN and other international other international bodies? Mm-hmm. Do they help sanctioned countries avoid sanctions? So like, are they mm-hmm. like, we have a rule. Are you helping people skirt the rule? Like that's an important thing for us to do this.
Are they feeding the Treasury's ability to conduct economic warfare mm-hmm. or not? Are they a Treasury...
Well, are they with the program or are they not? Like this is projection of soft power, right?
Yes.
Right. Are they supporting or opposing U.S. security efforts in various theaters? Like that's probably an important thing for a trade thing. Libertarians mm-hmm. might have like certain gripes about that because of war and stuff like that. But, you know, are they harboring terrorists or cyber criminals or other enemies of the U.S.? Do they grandstand against the U.S.? Does their state subsidize their labor force?
Okay, that's all of them, but
those are a bunch of things, right?
that's like nigh all of
how
them.
Much so? Like it's very much like a how much so, right? Uh-huh. So like these are things that went into the criteria, and mm-hmm. these were things that were talked about all the way in a report back in November.
Okay,
but so when we have Trump coming up with the chart, and they're just blowing like, how dare he? Like how dare he put these numbers? These numbers don't make sense, even though on the chart it says like tariffs and other. Non-tariff trade barriers. Like these are the non-tariff trade barriers mm-hmm. that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like they're just like making things up on the fly. Like that's the thing that is frustrating me.
So it depends on where you anchor to, mm-hmm. right? So on your theory, there's a larger anchor point, but I think what most people were operating on was the trade balance argument. And they're saying, well, this appears to be based upon trade balance. Is that a good aim? Number one. Number two, the numbers don't seem to match the trade balance question not sensibly in some cases.
Well, and this is the thing is like that might be the Peter Navarro argument or something. I actually don't know much about Peter Navarro. I don't really pay much attention to him. I'm paying more attention to like Bessent and Lutnick and people like that. But I'm also paying attention to guys like Stephen Moran and what they're talking about here.
Right.
balancing trade is not the goal here. And that's like very clear in this document.
Right. Well, and this is another watch what they do not with the say thing. Like the say thing has been about trade balance because Trump's been arguing trade balance questions because he sees trade deficits as a loss for the country.
Well, it's not specifically like that's actually too low resolution or too low resolution on what the Trumpian argument actually seems to be to me.
OK.
Is it's much more so like there's a big section in this document talking about the Triffin world. The Triffin dilemma, which Joe had brought up on a couple episodes ago.
Right.
And what this is the Triffin dilemma is a talk about the country with the world reserve status of in order for the reserve currency to kind of continue going and for it to be liquid throughout the global markets, the country actually has to run a trade deficit. Mm-hmm. In order for this to happen. But the dilemma and the paradox that exists with this is that as other countries are continuing to store up U.S. treasuries and store up like U.S. assets and be part of this, then it actually reduces the long-term projected value of the reserve currency. So you end up being in this dilemma here.
Okay.
And the critique that's being laid out in this document is like, yes, America is supposed to, because we get these privileges of being the world reserve currency. We kind of get like a bigger credit card and we get like, we kind of get to live beyond our means and all this stuff. Like that's kind of the aspect of this game that we're playing with the current order of that. What the Trumpian argument is that we're running a far larger deficit than we should be because people are cheating the rules to the game of the current order.
You're talking about trade deficit in this case. Okay.
Yeah, specifically trade deficits where it's like there should be an equilibrium that we should have been at, but because people are doing all these shenanigans, like they're manipulating their currency to make themselves be more competitive on exports and things of that nature because of that, like, you know, it's like basic, you know, where you have supply and demand and where the equilibrium hits, that's where it would be like where things would be natural to exist there. Uh-huh. But we have all these disruptions that are happening, making all of these different equilibrium points for all of these different factors of the American economy to be way off balance of where they're supposed to be.
Right.
Because people are cheating the rules to the game.
Yeah.
In the order.
Is there rules to the game?
Well, and this is the thing, is like we do have things like this is what things like the Plaza Accords were. This is things like what Bretton Woods were for. Like they are setting the rules to the international trade game.
Okay, well, tell me about the Plaza Accords because I'm not familiar with that.
The Plaza Accords was a 1980. The reason why I kind of bring it up actually is because I find it to be kind of funny where. All of these conversations are like they're all named after the resort that they stay at.
Yeah, right. Right.
Which is why. So like the first instance that I've ever seen the actual referring to of the Mar-a-Lago Accords is in this document.
Mm.
Where he talks about this multilateral strategy. He talks about multiple different strategies, but he says one of the big factors that we need to have is something akin to a Mar-a-Lago Accords where all these countries come together and actually revise and agree upon what the rules to this trade game are supposed to be if we are to continue this whole like world reserve currency status game. Because like, it's like we're doing that. And it's like the United States, like the US dollar is like, you know, there's the Fed and there's the manipulation of interest rates and like kind of the central planning aspect that happens there.
Right.
But like the US dollar is actually way freer than how these other countries' currencies operate.
Okay.
Like to extreme degrees. Like I explained the Chinese manipulation thing on a previous episode.
Yeah.
It's actually, let me pull this up because I think it helps to just see this in a chart here.
Charts are great.
Yeah. I put up the chart here where, so what you have here is the USD to the yuan.
Yeah.
And this is just this is just like, so there's a psychological barrier here that exists and it's at 7.3. You see every time it taps the 7.3.
Yeah.
This is where the PBOCs, the People's Bank of China, their defense mechanisms kick in and they try to make sure it gets back down. They always try to keep it within a 2% bandwidth. And ever since the tariff stuff, we're just like sitting here, we're pushing, and then they're pushing back, pushing back.
Yeah.
And this is probably going to be sticking around here.
Yeah. Jump into the 1 year because that'll probably give us a better sense of the tariff.
Yeah. So you kind of just see everything is, so like this is.
Oh, okay. No, yeah. Go to, Oh, okay.
Yeah. So like we're sitting and everything's just like, it's like, crank it back down, crank it back down, yeah, crank it back down. Right?
Right.
Because what the PBOC tries to do is they try to keep everything within a 2% thin band of, and this is like a promise that she makes to the exporters,
right?
Because you have all these really wealthy billionaire exporters in the country that really want to make sure that, because cheaper dollar makes you more, or cheaper local currency makes you more competitive on the overseas exports.
So, but my, okay, so a couple things I'm grappling with here, and I need you to sort me out. Okay, so which order to do them in? Number one, the idea that there is a known equilibrium between imports and exports, why would we anticipate that? I mean, like, that's not made sense to me. I watched Scott Bessin on Tucker, and he makes that case. And I don't think that doesn't work intuitively to me.
Really? To me, that makes sense.
Well, because the reason why is because imports and exports are different industries, people, and natural resource questions. I'm talking about the trade balance, but not just trade balance, but the sense in, and maybe you don't mean trade balance when you say that the import and exports should hit an equilibrium. And whether or not you that.
I don't mean that they should hit an equilibrium with each other.
Okay.
I'm just saying there is a point where it seems like the most natural point, given everything's like ceteris paribus of like what the like kind of the international order is supposed to be, it should be at this point. But because all these people are like, they're doing these currency manipulation games and things like that, it's causing us to kind of like our economy to reshuffle in a way that is kind of doing that gold water sucking sound. For our manufacturing, it's like it's not that we need to be a net exporter because of our manufacturing in America. It's just that our manufacturing should probably be higher than it currently is.
Okay,
because of these games that are being played on the international
stage. So in the sense of what was the agreement at the Plaza Accords then?
Let me pull up.
Was it an agreement not to do currency manipulation? Because that would be
no. Actually, what was actually going down was my understanding. This is an area that's a little bit more. I still need to do a little bit more digging onto this, but like my understanding is it was a sit down between the UK, France, Japan, United States, and someone else.
And this would be Jimmy Carter as president.
Yeah. Okay. And it was actually an effort to devalue the American dollar because it was becoming, they were very worried about it becoming too high. And this is another thing, is like the higher the value, the more that it's like you become more of a consumer importer than you do otherwise, right? And so like there was concerns about this massive imbalance that was happening back then.
Well, they needed to raise interest rates. So there's sensibleness in there. Because they needed, it was in 1979 that they bring in the Volcker Fed that raised interest rates so much to stop stagflation. So if the trade implication of that would be a stronger dollar. Mm-hmm. So therefore they bring in this negotiation that says we're going to be raising interest rates. We need you guys to do something so that we don't run into a trade problem.
And is that right? And it's important to also recognize for people that don't know about the Paul Volcker Fed chairman during that time is, and this is actually something that you see guys like Bessent invoke quite a bit. Like he did it on the Tucker Carlson, or maybe the All In podcast, maybe where he kind of compares the trade war here to the Volcker rate hikes. So at the end of the Jimmy Carter term, 79, Volcker cranked up interest rates to like 20%, like insane amounts. Like that's wild.
Yeah.
And then Reagan came in because
and kept him on.
And they all stayed on for about 2 years. And Reagan lost the midterms. Like Reagan was actually quite unpopular in his first term because the economy still wasn't getting figured out because people were still devastated from the. Because remember, during the Carter economy, people were rationing gas.
Yeah, right.
It was bad.
It was really bad. It's a typical political trap, right? Where the stagflation is created by all the previous presidents. It's crazy that Carter comes in, does a couple reforms, and brings in Volcker, and then. Because of stagflation that he was trying to tackle, he actually goes out, Reagan comes in. Reagan pays a penalty for the Volcker thing, but by keeping him on was actually the thing that set him up for the later terms.
Also pairing it with deregulation and tax cuts too.
Right.
Like that stuff also came in, which is part of the Trump plan here. Like this is the big, beautiful bill and all this stuff, right? Like I kind of worry about putting it all into one bill. Like Trump's just like, it makes it more big and more beautiful, but like I often worry about like one big bill sometimes, but we'll see how this goes. We'll see tax cuts, which like we're going to be seeing tax cuts, which I think is going to be very good for the economy. And then we're also going to be seeing the deregulation push. So this is kind of the idea here is in combination with this restructuring of the global order, we have been at relatively high interest rates. We're not 20%. We're like, a, what, 5%?
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, but compared to 0%, compared where to, we were at forever.
Yeah, yeah, under Obama, we were at 0%. Yeah. So what we're probably going to wind up seeing is, in combination with tax cuts, deregulation, this restructuring of the economy and all this manufacturing beginning to get built here, and then interest rates beginning to come down, which appears to be what's probably going to be happening in May, June. Like, we'll see where Jay Powell works. You know, there's been kind of the tit for tat going on with Trump and Jay Powell.
Yeah.
We're going to see this combination that will lead into a massive economic boom in the future. So it's like short, and this is the short-term pain, long-term gain feature.
That's the idea.
And under Reagan, what we ended up happening was Reagan lost Congress on his midterms, but then came back for his reelection and he won 49 states.
So right? let me give you a conspiracy theory. One of the reasons why we can't do anything about spending is because it is the only way that they can continue to devalue the dollar. Keep it weaker than otherwise would.
Maybe. I've thought about that too.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's where it's actually winds up, and that's the true motive here. Like, they can't just balance a budget and actually fill a campaign promise. They do this because they think they know better than everybody else about what was really going on, which is really going on is the trade.
Yeah, it is one of these things because, like, because of this whole dynamic of how the world economy is structured, it just allows America to put this big credit card, like, to have this massive credit card.
Yeah.
That other countries could not have. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's like a world agreement that that's allowed to happen, right? Like, that's the, which then allows us to continue doing this spending like over and over again. But then you have the dynamics of like, well, those interest rates are going to keep up, like catch up on you. And this is part of the discussion, and it's discussed in this document from Stephen Moran too, is like, you know, it's okay for us to spend over the limit, but like, we got to be very careful on how much we're spending. Like, that's the problem here. And like, and this is the kind of another one of those kind of like equilibrium points where like, we are spending way above our means. Like, we're allowed to, as the reserve currency, to spend above our means, but we're not allowed to, but we still can't spend that much above our means.
There's an outer boundary, right? Yeah. in which their trade-offs are substantial.
Exactly.
And we're near that outer boundary.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so like, it's stuff like that where I'm like, it's like that. This is the frustrating thing to me, where when we're talking about this dynamic, is like there's a lot of conversation at play, and there's like a lot of variables to the plan, and there's like a planned outcome that is happening.
It's kind of like our last topic, where they just strawman the hell out of Putin in order to set the stage for their predetermined theory that they want to advance. And in this case, you don't really see people. And I was really happy with the last time we covered tariffs, in part because you did such a good job of steel manning the Trumpian argument.
And
you
know, I had so many people messaging me about it too. Yeah. Like, being like, whoa. Like, I had a lot of people like, so I'm glad you appreciated it.
The question is like, and we begged that then, and we should beg it now, which is, if spending cuts are part of that in order to strengthen the dollar and in order to strengthen American exports, in currency manipulation to the same degree that we're going to strengthen the dollar. At that point, that'd be better for American consumers in many ways, especially for savings and things like that, but not best for American exports. So you have this weird,
dilemma,
push pull right? dilemma that you're like, can you twist that knob just the right amount? And do you have the basis for the claim that they are gaming the system to such a degree that people are willing to take the, you know, if you can't make the pick case publicly, that never gets to people, that suggests that they are gaming the system, and this is a short-term pain for the long-term gain. Are you going to be successful in pulling off removing three stool legs and sticking them back in, you know, all in one go?
It is interesting because like there's also a dynamic here. So like maybe let's talk about, because I think that there's interesting trends here that exist with where certain negotiations are standing with countries. Uh-huh. We'll start with China. They're still blustering. This is going to take some time. The China one is going to take a long time. I was actually asking Grok about this, especially when I was, because the currency manipulation thing, this is a thing that I've just always heard, and I've never actually understood what people were talking about with it.
Right.
And then I actually went and looked at the mechanics of how it works.
Right.
And so like now I'm kind of like, oh, like I understand how they manipulate the, because like, it's just like Trump's always said this.
Yeah.
China's manipulating our currency. I'm like, Okay.
Well, straighten me out on this, because my first response to that is usually, well, everyone manipulates their currency, because that's the definition of having a monopoly on your money supply.
Yeah, but we don't do this type of stuff. Like, that's the thing. It's like their countries are playing the Forex markets to create, like, artificially create extremely good trade deals for themselves and for their exporters.
Well, I mean, not good trade deals for themselves, good trade deals for a constituency of them.
Yeah, exactly. Because
They would benefit also if they had stronger imports.
But this is also the same thing. So, like, when Scott Bessent broke the Bank of England and the pound collapsed, the reason – what was going on was the pound was pegged to the European exchange mechanism is what it was called, where they were doing this pegging feature like Europe's love to peg.
I know.
Europeans love to peg.
It's so gay. but yes.
It is Europe.
Keep going with the pegging.
They were doing the same type of thing. But their market with that was only like $40 billion at the time, where the Chinese market with this is $3 trillion. So that was something that was able to kind of quickly happen, where the Chinese short option here is like, this is probably going much to larger. Take Grok. I actually asked Grok of like to give me estimations on things. Grok specifically said that it thought that China would probably be forced to come to an agreement in 6 to 8 months, because in about 14 to 16 months is where everything will start to go very bad. That's what Grok told me.
Interesting.
If you trust
and what does going very bad look like? In this case, for China specifically, is it weaknesses in their export markets because of the pressure on tariffs, or what are we looking at?
What we're probably going to see on this Chinese chart is this starts to push towards 7.3.
You should call them the red Chinese, by the way.
The red Chinese. That's the bold.
Sorry.
magic number is they're trying to kind of keep it between 7.2 and 7.3. I think that we're going to end up seeing this start to push towards 7.5. They're probably going to have to eventually start to sell off their U.S. treasuries, things like that. And excuse me. Sorry.
Burps happen. It's all right.
Burps happen.
It's a podcast.
They're probably going to begin to sell off U.S. treasuries, which is their last resort, according to policy.
Right.
Is when they start doing that. Like, when they start doing that, you'll know things are bad. And there's probably, because, like, Xi isn't just, like, supreme dictator of China. Like, he's got a constituency. He's got a lot of people who are, like, newly made Chinese billionaires and things like that. Like, it doesn't matter how much he saves face if everything starts to collapse, because he's going to be trying to save face as much as possible.
Collapsing in this point is Chinese export markets. But if they can just export to another country like Brazil or Russia or Africa or whatever, and no large import markets there, but you see what I mean? Like if they can't find elasticity within the demand, then they're out of, then they have to come to the table on something.
Actually,
that's sensible.
This actually reminds me. So Scott Bessent, my boy, who I always hype up.
Speaking of pegging,
he did a speech and Q&A at the at this like Global Outlook Forum, and he was kind of talking about the China thing, where China wants their markets to go, and being like, "Yo, we can help you. Like, we both want to restructure our markets, so like we can be friends here."
Let's see.
So,
our Chinese counterparts that will come to this realization, and if some of our policies, sometimes it takes an external push.
Right.
Alternatively, what I have said previously, there is an opportunity for a big deal here, that the U.S. is looking to rebalance to more manufacturing. The identity of that would be less consumption. If China is serious on less dependence on export-led manufacturing growth and a rebalancing toward a domestic economy, I think they use the term dual circulation. Well, it's really singular circulation. And if they want to rebalance, let's do it together. This is an incredible opportunity. And I think if Bridgewater founder Ray Dalio were to write something, he could call it a beautiful rebalancing.
So, and that's saying that more sells within China to other Chinese, right? And he's saying that would be richer for the Chinese.
That's a stated goal they have. too.
So, wait, are we saying that the Chinese don't consume their own products at all?
Not in the manner that they want to.
Not in the rate that
this is
could.
A publicly stated goal that they have, is that they want to do this dual band structure, where it's like right now they're like their whole thing is we are exporting to the world these cheap goods.
Uh-huh.
And but like,
but wealth is on the rise in China over the long term. We're seeing the rise of a Chinese middle class, all those kinds of things. And that was always predicted as
I think is what they want to focus on. They want to actually have an economy for that middle class.
Right. Well, but what I'm saying is they already have that. They've developed that. Now they don't have as larger middle class as maybe they want or they could have or something like that, but they already have that. So how is that happening if all the goods are going overseas? I just don't understand.
Well, because I think what we have is it's the people that get very specifically the people that have the jobs which are very low paying jobs. So like those are still, it's still like lower class jobs that all of this is benefiting.
Yeah, we need those here. We need more low class jobs.
I think we need jobs for every class.
Yeah, right.
Like that's the thing, right?
Yeah, sure.
But they need the economy to be circulating for that those people that are growing out of that.
Uh-huh.
And right now they don't really have the economy for like the people that have grown out of the lower class.
Well, right? and it's always hard to tell because especially like,
need those desk jobs. They need those. Right. Like, right?
I'm no China expert. I've never been there, but it seems to me
never
that
been?
If you are a private company in China and you are taking some of the things you manufacture and send them overseas, that it does make sense to also send some of those things to your domestic markets because
and I imagine
you don't have transportation costs and all that kind of thing for your margin.
Yeah, I imagine they are. But like again, it's one of those things where but where's the infrastructure for the people that have now made the money to kind of elevate out of lower class, right? Like they don't have the infrastructure in the job market and things like that for the middle class life yet. Like there's people that are elevating themselves, but then it's like they're elevating themselves to
middle class, right?
Like, which is kind of like the infrastructure for having a middle class is not there though, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
And remember, cause like China is like very centrally planned and everything.
Yeah, I know. Like, that's always like, one of the harder things to contend with here. Because you're looking at our central bank against
like all
their
the jobs
central
are
bank.
Factory work. Like all of the jobs are kind of like menial labor factory work. Like that's all they have.
They have to have some service industry, but imagine it's less than otherwise it would be if the Chinese currency was stronger within the world markets because their central bank wouldn't be undermining them.
Mm-hmm.
So get rid of all the governments. What would be the theoretical scenario here?
Because they're way off equilibrium too.
Right. Well, at least that's the case. So you're thinking we're going to continue with the high rates of China. I thought I saw something this week that suggested that Trump was kind of indicating that it's not going to stay there forever. So the outer band of that, you're trying to say like if they restructure the agreement with their central bank, then we'll be in a situation where we can lower these trade barriers and we can
you stop doing all these manipulations and stuff like that, right? Like that's the big.
But even if we do that, then that's forecasting a world where we get less Chinese goods because we've push them to sell them their goods domestically.
But then we increase jobs here of people wanting to do these things, right?
Assuming we can. I mean, that's like the EPA question, right?
It's well,
like,
and that's the big thing is the regulatory side is the biggest hindrance. To me, the regulatory side is the biggest hindrance to all of this.
Yeah, and spending cuts. It seems like those are the two hardest things for them to actually accomplish.
Yeah, but like the spending cuts aren't as much of a disruptor on this plan per se. It's like the regulatory side is like the thing that is the disruptor for this overall grand scheme, right? Because like tax cuts looks like it's going to be happening. Are they going to be as strong as they want? Who knows?
We'll see.
But like the regulatory side is like that's the slow moving thing that it's just going to take forever to gut.
Mm-hmm. Without a bill.
And because we're seeing all these companies, like a lot of the stuff is moving into the US now. Like there's a lot of these promises that are being made and the investment structures that are being made for this to happen, but that stuff takes time.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the other stuff. Other countries here that are happening with this is it's just interesting to see who is making progress and who is not making progress. I think that's interesting on the geopolitical winds.
Right.
European Union have described themselves as having little progress with the United States. they're also moving to lift all of their sanctions with China.
So that would increase the elasticity of Chinese exports. They'll bypass America and go to Europe.
Which was my prediction on the Europe episode.
Yeah.
I said that we're going to see Europe-China coalition.
Right.
Everybody else is going to be kind of away from that. Canada. Carney is saying Trump is attacking Canada.
Uh-huh.
And is imposing retaliatory tariffs, right? So That's interesting. But what we're seeing, a lot of progress being made in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Verbally, from a lot of the Southeast Asian countries, there have been positive progress.
You're talking about the duck fucking guy?
Yeah, Vietnam. Vietnam. Yep, yep. Vietnam is one of those, but also like Malaysia, countries like that.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of the dialogue is discussing around lessening dependence on China, which is interesting. So there's the kind of isolatory factor that exists here. But also India and Taiwan were interesting to me. India is making an offer of $200 billion worth of energy purchases.
Okay.
As part of their trade deals.
We're talking like liquid natural gas on a tanker sort of thing? Oof.
Yep.
That's spendy.
Taiwan proposed a Taiwan-U.S. coalition, including also a $200 billion energy purchase. So a lot of this stuff is energy related.
Yeah, helping the IRI, right?
Mm-hmm. Australia is still in early talks, but there's a lot of talk around agriculture and rare earth minerals. Rare earth minerals being a very important factor in the AI game of everything that's going. And then there's also the Russia aspect. Now, Russia is not as part of this because we already are sanctioning Russia, right? Mm-hmm. So there is no trade going. But assume the peace process happens. There's a new major variable that exists here.
Right. And you can rebuild Russia as per Vance's comments, right? Mm-hmm. Building a better Russia, building all that kind of stuff.
And if I'm right about, because like people tend to forget, like everybody's always focused on Western Russia. Like we are bordering Eastern Russia, right?
Yeah,
like I can see Russia from my house.
Right. Sarah Palin.
It's like, there's the energy connection.
Uh-huh.
Like that connection's made. There's some pipeline that goes Russia, Alaska there that is developed. Like that's what I think the major play is going
to
be.
Why would you want that? Because all your consumption of that energy is all eastward or westward for Russia, eastward for America.
I think that's just going to be the alliance structure that is made. Because part of the deals that are being made with some of the Southeast Asian countries are that they're going to be playing a role and participating in the financing of a bunch of energy production in Alaska too. So there's a lot of, like, this is just an area that nobody's really talking about. Bessent mentioned it in an interview recently. Like, is that these are some of the deals that are made. It's not necessarily just trade, because it's not about balancing trade per se. It's like balancing what we do for each other.
Yeah.
It's like, we are the reserve currency of the world. We're going to be running deficits, but there's other things that you can be doing for us to help facilitate that role, you know? Like, so it's like, if you're going to help us with financing of something, then we will strike better deals with you on this. And, you know, like those are the types of things that are also being made. It's not about just like the wonkiness of like this number equal this number.
Yeah,
like
it's
not that.
You can see if you're doing the multivariable, then there's going to be other things to rely on. Now, the question, it seems like to me that is can you persist the deals over time, over a long enough time horizon where it still makes sense, right? Or is this, if you're Southeast Asia or you're India or whatever, is this going to be the sword of Damocles always hanging over your head forever now? Of if we don't do exactly what the Americans want, they're going to smash us with tariffs.
Well, and this is the thing to me, because like this is the thing that I'm respecting about Trump in this whole process, is that I think that prior to him coming in, there were a lot of things in the American executive branch when it came to this stuff that's just kind of like holding on to certain assumptions that weren't true.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
It sounds like government. Yeah.
Just exactly.
Kind of like the momentum is actually more important than most of the facts on the ground. At any given time.
Yeah, exactly. So it becomes this thing where like, because like I'll always remember this on the campaign trail with Trump was talking about Shinzo Abe and his relationship with Shinzo Abe of Japan before he was assassinated, and he said that he went to Shinzo and was like, Shinzo, I was looking at some of the like when I came in, I was looking at some of the trade stuff that was going on with us, and just like, you guys are kind of screwing us over. What's going on? And Abe, and Trump said that Abe looks at it, is like, oh, President Trump, like, oh, President, I was worried that you would come to me with this because you're smarter than your predecessor. But like, you know, so it's like those types of things where there's just like, it's like, cause like, and this is where I'm like, oftentimes in the libertarians, everybody's like, trade is good. Trade is good. Trade is good. But it's like, you can always get better trade. Like there can be better trade.
The question is like, how is if the degree that you're confident that you can make a better deal with Scott Bessent, right? Like a person on top who's looking at the whole thing and thinks he knows what the better arrangement would be. In the absence of the Fed and the absence of all these other things, we'd see very different investments out of South India or India and South Asia. In trade-offs to this, that would be more maximally beneficial for them and us. But you have someone on top saying, well, what's really important is Alaskan energy, not because it's necessarily the most important thing, but because that fits the books for the IRI and their ambitions for funding the International Republican Institute and the,
but that, know, being, the but that being said, we do need more energy. Like that, it's very clear though, especially if we're to be advancing in this like AI tech revolution.
Right,
we need more energy.
Yeah, but I think the criticism, and once again, it's just that confidence you have of, you know, are the people who are planning it the right way? Mm-hmm. Because we're dealing with the status quo of planning, right? So how to grapple with that? It's an understandable criticism. Say we shouldn't be planning this. We should have zero trade barriers. Companies that want to have countries that want to have zero trade barriers themselves are just damaging their people. Like those arguments are still valid while operating with a, but we're not there. So therefore, what's the best thing?
And
we
also
can do?
Another area of my critique with the libertarians is like, oftentimes it's looking as if only America has any of the agency in any of this. It's like other countries are also doing other things and we have to contend with that.
Don't do the agency thing to me. I hate that.
But I think it's true though. Right? No, like, is that not true? Like,
no, what I'm referencing is Maidan didn't happen because with American investment because agency. I'm making a joke.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where I see this and this is often I often feel this all the time. Where everything's always focused on America does this, America does that, America. But like we also are living in a world where there's other actors involved. Sure. So like we need people that are going in and negotiating stuff, right? Because that's the world we live in right now. It's like if we lived in Disneyland, then we could have other conversations. But right now it's like we have to have an executive that is in his branch that is performing negotiations because that's how the world is structured moment. Right?
And it's that and it's – I think you would – There would be a lot of credit to it when they say, and the end goal is a state where exporters and importers, individual business and businessmen can make investments to benefit people overseas with as minimal amount of barriers as possible. If that's the end goal, you can be like, okay, that's you're trying to cultivate those folks to say you're trustworthy in that space. If it's, well, we're going to do this forever. You know,
which is not
the
case
forever trade war,
but,
right?
But that's also not the case that they're making. They're not making the case for a forever trade war, right?
Exactly.
Well, and that's why
it depends on whether or not you trust them, right? Is like, is this really what they're going, or are they just telling me what I want to hear, right? And I think skepticism is warranted because there's been so much conflicting messaging.
But the thing is, it's like I don't feel like it's been that conflicting. Like I feel like everybody's trying to make it more complicated than it is. I think the people have been actually quite clear about this, and this is kind of.
I don't mean from what they've said. I mean from what people have heard.
Yeah, right. I agree. And that's why. So when we first covered the tariffs, when they first happened, before the suspension and the pause happened, this is why on that episode, I was very clear and I wanted to make sure the audience recognized this because I saw the dialogue that was happening around this, where it's like, I'm listening to the people that are actually making the decisions. And they're talking about things like sometimes you have to escalate to de-escalate, right? Yeah. Like that was the Scott Bessent say. And then what happened that next week? They escalated and then they de-escalated, right? So like these things are going as they are saying. And like there's going to be some things don't hit the mark exactly right. Like plans never go completely correctly. But I'm trying to make sure that people understand that there is a method to the madness. And it's not just like, because like people go to college and they take an economics class and they're like, tariffs are bad because it's a tax. Sure. And like, and then all the libertarians are just like, tariffs are bad because it's a tax. I'm just like, okay. Tree, like that's a tree. We're talking about a forest here. Like there is a plan to be made here to the point where some of these countries are going to zero tariffs, where it's going to be zero tariffs on both sides. Right. Argentina is the example of that. Mm-hmm. Actually, in this speech that Bessent gave, he actually he criticized the IMF and the World Bank. And he talked about what the proper roles of those should be and how they have gone away from mission creep. And he used Argentina as the example of someone that should be praised, where what the IMF in the past, their metrics were how much money can we lend out? And that's like how good they're doing. He said, no, if we're going to be participating in this IMF game, then we need from countries, from the developing countries that are being lent out money from the IMF, we need strategic benchmarks that can be met on timelines. And Argentina has passed with flying colors, and this is the proper role of the IMF. Mm. Other countries that cannot meet those benchmarks, and if it's just becoming, now I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he's kind of like, if it just starts becoming like a slush fund, that's a problem.
Yeah.
What Milei is doing is great, right? And this is an example of, In El Salvador, it was kind of the opposite thing that had happened under the Biden administration. The IMF was labeling Bukele as a terrorist and is like, we cannot work with this Bukele guy, blah, 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 all this stuff. Yeah. And the IMF was the big one pushing of like, this guy needs to go, blah, blah, blah. And like, that's what he's talking about, where like they've expanded beyond their mission. Mm. It's like all they care about is social policy and climate change.
Right.
And that is how they're basing all of their lending practices around. Mm. That's not what we should be doing. Right. So like, this is what we're talking about when like these are the levers and mechanisms that they're trying to work with here. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Anyways. Yeah.
One more thing that happened is Rand Paul put together a congressional bill in order to try to push back on the president's tariffs and try to return the power to Congress to decide tariff rates, because that was where it started. And then during the Cold War, they kind of took up they delegated that power away to the presidency in order to better fight and arrange the global economy using the president. What do you think about that?
I see the argument, and I think a few years ago I would have agreed with Rand Paul, but my views on the executive branch have changed since then quite a bit, and this is a power that makes more sense to me to be operating under the president, to me. And it's largely because, and maybe if there was a different president, I would maybe have a different opinion. This is probably one of those things, and maybe this is hypocritical. It is probably one of those things where it depends who's in office,
right?
But like, to me, it's what I'm looking at with the tariff policy. It's just like, I don't know, it feels like it would be so much messier if tariff had to have, or if Congress had to be hyper-involved in this stuff.
Think about it like this. Like, in order to get a bill through Congress, it is so difficult in the current climate. Mm-hmm. Now, it shouldn't be that difficult. There should be way more debate. There should be way more, like, engagement. I mean, even a fraction of what your average state legislature accomplishes in 90 days would be an incredible legislative session for Congress. Like, 1% of what a state legislature does. These kind of processes work in 50 states, but they don't work on the federal government. So you're looking at that existing status quo and you're saying, like, that sounds disastrous because China can act on these things quickly. India can act on these things quickly. Yeah. Even Germany can. Like, all these other countries can move quickly, but we're not with our status quo. So it could be this isn't the right time. But it's definitely true that as far as what businesses look to for investment questions is, how reliable is the bet I'm making going to pay off over the time horizon I'm looking at? And that's not the Trump time horizon specifically, by AIM, because they're saying we're trying to rework all these things. And, you know, if anything, it's another timing question thing. Like, that's the great thing to do after Trump has rearranged the global economy, assuming he can. I'm not confident he can. I'm not confident that's possible. But once he's gotten to that new place and he can say, you know, mission accomplished, then you take action, remove this power from the presidency, because it can just be turned around by the next president. Right?
Yeah. It's one of those things, because like there's certain, and my time in crypto has kind of told me this too, about centralization versus decentralization. And there was a point in time where I was like a decentralization maxi on everything. Like, everything should be supremely decentralized.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what giving things to Congress is that's like decentralization. Like, and it's kind of acts as a bit of a defense mechanism in a sense. But as I've spent all this time in crypto, I see this value of, like, sometimes it's very useful to have certain things centralized, but it's also other things that's very useful to have decentralized. And there's kind of like a balance that exists there. And a lot of the geopolitical stuff, to me, feels like it's better to have in the hands of the executive, which is kind of, geopolitical stuff is kind of the realm of the president. It's kind of what it's designed to be. And I see tariffs as a geopolitical tool, where I see most other forms of taxation as much more of a, like, those make sense to be in Congress, right? Where tariffs are kind of like a different category to me.
Well, okay. So the way the founders would have put it is that the challenge is that your president has a singular interest of a singular person,
while that's the hard part.
Congress as multiple interests that are competing with each other to try to come up with consensus across interests that will then allow you to elevate to the president. Now,
where it's not clean for me. Like I understand that.
So the challenge is if the next president is captured by China
exactly.
and really wants a heavy China's export markets, because they have, you know, they're more closely aligned in interest with the U.S. importers, then you're in a, you know, you're in a seesaw, which prevents business from being able to anticipate the future.
This is where people will hate me, and this is the problem with term limits, is it's really difficult to have geopolitical relations when every 4 years it changes.
Yeah. it was possible. It just became increasingly impossible the further that we got into the Cold War and into the post-Cold War consensus. And
we've become so much more polarized. Yeah.
Flipping everything around every 4 years or 8 to 8 years.
It's like, imagine you're Modi.
Based upon the size of the government.
Yeah. Like, right? Imagine you're Modi in India and you're having to be like, you just had to deal with Biden and now you're having to deal with Trump.
Right.
Like, or Putin.
Right.
Like, and we're talking about like an actual ongoing war, and the two different presidents that you're jumping have completely different outlooks on it, right? Like that's really difficult on a geopolitical perspective. Yeah. And it's like hard to.
But I would rather have that than have FDR, right? Where he's serving.
Well,
for
that's the hard thing.
16 something years.
It's like,
right?
I would love to have unlimited terms for somebody I like, and I would like to term limit people I don't like.
Exactly.
Right? Like that's the actual reality.
Yeah, but that's not. But that's the furthest idea from reality.
But I feel that way about Congress too. Like, I would like to have Thomas Massie in forever.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we should have term limits on congressmen. Like, I would like to have Rand Paul there forever. I would like to have Mike Lee there forever.
But you're also like guaranteeing Chuck Schumer's there forever.
Yeah. But to me, that's more of a, like, in a lot of ways, the people that represent you, you're getting what you get. Like, you're kind of getting the representatives that you deserve.
There's a sense in which that's true. And there's also a sense in which, you know, the political system is so separated from people's lives and their ability to actually grapple with, you know, what's going on in politics.
Yeah, this is the flaw of democracy.
Yeah, right. Is that it's hard to give them actual credit for that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that these are leaders that are done by meme and low resolution pictures of who they are by their category of being Republican or their TV ads or whatever that are highly manipulative. That it's hard to I always kind of repel at the idea of blaming the voters for the end results here, because that itself has lots of assumptions built into it about their actual knowledge, capability, and availability of options.
I don't know, because I look at it and I'm like, Nancy Pelosi represented San Francisco well. Like, she's a San Francisco person. Like, she's a San Francisco politician. I don't like it.
Yeah, well,
but apparently San Franciscans do.
Well, now right? Do Kentucky, where you're elected Mitch McConnell forever
versus
and
Rand Paul.
Yeah. You know, it's like are we getting the Rousseauian general will here, or are we getting
highly
manipulated you know, interest groups that are
Kentucky just wants to have the entire Overton window. It's like, we're Republican, but like, we're this Republican and that Republican. Like, we have the entire breadth of the window.
So like, the theory there, I just always struggle with, but I'm still making the point that, you know, the question seems to me that if you can embody this in a deal so that you have firm deals in which to adjudicate those, if the deal that you're originally talking about, forgive me, it was
Plaza Accords.
The Plaza Accords were never actually written down or passed by, you know, the Senate, that it wasn't a real deal. Right, it's not a treaty that we're talking about here. This is a verbal deal. Now, that doesn't mean you can violate it. There still should be a standing for that in international court, international opinion. But, you know, it seems like to me that you're making a better bet on business, future investment, and the prosperity associated with that if you have long-term actual set results that you can then play out. And this seems like to me the Senate by treaty, like we were doing with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is in that sense the better model. I'm not saying that was a better deal for global trade or whatever. I'm just saying that the model itself might be better.
Well, and that is the thing. Like, I think like that's a good point. But there's one of these things is like, I'm seeing how this shakeup is happening right now. And it's like, I feel like in order to get the outcome that is necessary, I feel like Trump and Besant are correct. My assessment of this right now is that they are correct, that we needed to flood the system with this to like show how far we're willing to go to have that bully tactic for the negotiations to actually work correctly. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if these were just like, if we were just like, oh, we're going to all have a summit together before this happened.
Yeah.
I don't think the structure of this, of like whatever would come to the Senate in the future
right.
in a treaty, I don't think it would come out the way that it would now be coming out.
And
right?
I'm actually, you know what I mean? I think I'm like, open to that, right? I'm open to the idea that you need a firm negotiation standard to deviate you from the status quo.
It's big stick negotiation.
It's just like
that's what it is.
Yeah, and the question is what's the next step after that? Mm-hmm. What's the one that actually lays out the time horizon so that you can actually create the investment so you can... Because you can't do American manufacturing under this current environment, right?
No,
that's
you can't.
Clear.
You can't.
Right? Not just from a regulatory standpoint, but tariffs jerking around every single way. Because if you're like, I'm sourcing from China, not anymore. Vietnam, I don't know. Maybe tomorrow that won't be that way. Oh, man, I'm going to go to Cambodia. Exactly. You know, like wherever those things that you are to source the materials. And this is an interesting one, too, because the things that in order to make things, we have to import things that make the things. Right, the structure of production has to be created out of someplace. Not to mention the challenge of just very low savings rate, difficulty over getting loans, all that kind of stuff that goes with the kind of chaotic environment. So at some point it has to level, and where you level it at, how long you can maintain it seems really important for this to actually play out the way they want it to.
You know, it's another interesting signal is at this speech that Bessent gave. This last week, he opened up his speech with a very good slogan. I felt like he said that America first does not mean America alone. Mm. That was what he was trying to give to the international community on this of like we're not. Don't listen to the media that we're just purely trying to isolate ourselves. Mm. It's like we're focusing on us. We're taking this new policy of thinking like. Our people should probably come first. But we also think that you all should be taking that with your own policies, mm-hmm. but we want to work together. Like we don't want to just be like, oh, we're only making our stuff. Like mm-hmm. he tried to make that very clear in the messaging there. Because this is another one of those things where people are putting on to Trump and the administration this idea that it's just like America built everything, like it's only America made. It's only and like there are a lot of like low resolution Trump voters that see it that way, where they only want it all to be built in America. But like that's not what the Trump administration is actually saying.
Right.
Like it's just like we want there to be more of a focus in that regard than there has been in the past. Mm-hmm. But we also still want to have trade relations. Like we still
well,
want
you
this.
Need to. At 350 million. People.
Like we want to have these relations exist still. Right. And like, but like everybody, and this is where my frustrations with the whole topic of is like people are it's nonstop arguing with straw men. Like these people aren't, they're not just saying pure isolationism. Like that's not what they're saying.
It's just like Israel, Palestine, Russia, Ukraine. It's never on the actual topic. It's always a distraction to keep you from like dealing with the most recent thing. On talking about the topic. It's like when you're arguing with your girlfriend and she says, I really don't like the tone.
the tone that you're making.
Yeah, right. Yeah. As opposed to that, like now we're talking about the tone I'm using, not the thing I was originally talking about.
Well, yeah. And it's just like, because like people are sitting here and it's just like they have this like fantasy version of what's happening. And it's like you're not contending with reality at all.
Right.
Like, and that's where my frustration is. And this is why like I often critique the libertarians because I come from that camp. Originally, but like
originally.
I see myself. I mean, I
at some point you just gotta cut the cord, Kyle. You're not anymore. You are.
I think
get on or get off. No more fencing.
I think it's one. Well, I'm completely open to that. Like, I don't think libertarians would want me anymore. Like, I'm just looking at that. Like, I saw how failed they were over the last 8 years on things. Like, I watched it happen. But it's important to kind of like. So often they're sitting here like talking about trade-offs and they're talking about like this or that. And they're usually like within their own world, able to contextualize things properly. But as soon as they're talking about this stuff, all of a sudden everything's just dogma everywhere. And it's just like, it's like, can't have a conversation with you.
I don't think that's unique to libertarians. I think that happens across the brain, especially the legacy press, but even things like good new media outlets that I see like Breaking Points. For example, when they cover tariffs, all of a sudden Crystal Ball becomes a... free market libertarian, right? It's really interesting. And then Sagar's over here saying like, I'm for autarky, but this is wild. I can't believe we're getting repercussions for tariffs, you know? So you just have this, there's this, and no one ever gets around to the actual, what's the aim? Are we matching the aim with action? Those sorts of questions.
Everybody's stuck in these like these insider games. It's like, well, NPR had an insider report this, or Axios had an insider report this. And it's just like, and those are all, and we rightfully so bashed those away in the very beginning of the Trump administration. There was a lot of that stuff happening. But right. then the people that the people that rightfully so bashed those away back right. in January are right. now using those because like because their inability to just read the document, they're now like putting these fantasy scenarios in their head. And it was like, Axios probably got it right this time. Yeah. And he was like, no.
Well, or at least that this dynamic that seems to be the actual narrative carrying capacity for the entire way that the public is conceptualizing tariffs is that this week there was a leaked document, there leaked information to an organization that says that Trump talked to somebody who convinced them to cut tariffs right now or increase tariffs right now or whatever. And that becomes the central piece of what's going on, not like what is the actual policy we're trying to pursue and are we hitting the actions to match that policy.
Yeah.
And so that difference is leading a lot of people astray, and it's understandable.
Yeah.
Right. It's even like the best motivated people, because you're over here saying, and this happened on some of our stuff that went on X, is like people are saying, well, trade balance isn't important. We're like, I agree. Trade balance is not the right goal. If it's something else beyond that, and this is a component to what they're talking about, or at least that, and this is something that the Trump administration maybe owns, is message discipline or internal leak discipline or whatever to get them to actually align people's public expectations with the things that they're doing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because if you fail there, then people think you're doing something you're not doing. And then when you, even if you get to the status quo you want, they're going to be like, What was all that for? Does that make sense?
Yeah, because it's one of those things. It's exactly like one of those things right there is the trade balance thing. It's just like they're like people are talking about this trade balance stuff, and it's like that's not really the picture of what's going on.
If you look at it in isolation, right? That the trade balance thing that's a part of a larger theory. It is an argument that people around the administration have brought in order to justify the tariffs. I mean, I'm watching them do it.
And I think a lot of people are arguing with Trump supporters more so than they're arguing with the administration. And then those things are being conflated together because these are complicated things. They require you to dive into it and actually kind of study and contend with the ideas. Mm-hmm. And 99% of people aren't doing that. So people are having these battles, and what it's resulting in is these fantasy battles. You're not contending with anything. You're just saying shit. You're having drinks and talking shit. That's what you're doing.
That is where we're at on so many issues right now. And that's what we're going to do the skiff on, is we're going to be talking about Podcastistan and Constant Kissing Boys doing his thing on trying to determine the terms of debate by setting up Mott and Bailey's and straw men.
Another European coming to lecture me about what I should do.
Yeah, so we'll be diving into
that. I'm sensing
a
theme there.
But if you want to get access to the skiff, our whole catalog of members only stuff, check it out. Join on humanreactionpod.com, .org. I might just spaced it. Holy
cow. .com.
I don't know.
Normally Joe does this.
Yeah,
as you can tell, this is
incompetent.
As soon as Bennett and Joe left us, we are not a well-oiled machine. We're just I don't know. We went like an hour over. I don't know where we are.
Well, you got to deduct the time that you threw coffee at me.
That is true. I did throw coffee. Things weren't correct. Things were getting haywire on the production side.
But
we'll see how this works. Bennett, we love you.
Yeah, 100%. So before we go, what's the takeaway? What's the final takeaway? How should people understand global trade and where we're at right now with the Trump tariff battle? Like, what is the shorthand for people to understand, grab onto?
Zoom out beyond your dogma for a second. That's like, because that's where I'm frustrated, is people are too isolated on their one dogmatic thing that they can continue repeating. And it is obstructing thinking.
Right.
So just zoom out, see the bigger picture. There's plenty of areas to disagree with, I'm sure. I just find the whole, as somebody who kind of enjoys economic history, I find the whole thing very fascinating and what's going on. The more I learn, the more bullish I am becoming on it. When I first went into this thinking about tariffs a long time ago, like in the last year even, I had some thoughts where I was beginning to stray and change my mind on tariffs, but the more I've dug and done actual research, had some conversations with Grok, stuff like that, the more bullish I am becoming on this whole scenario in the long term.
Right on. Yeah. So don't forget, like, subscribe, throw a comment below, let us know what you think, and we'll catch you next time on Human Reaction.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.